chapter 72, the rebellion of Absalom. He shall restore fourfold had been David's unwitting sentence upon himself on listening to the prophet Nathan's parable, and according to his own sentence he was to be judged. Four of his sons must fall, and the loss of each would be a result of the father's sin. The shameful crime of Ammon, the firstborn son, was permitted by David to pass unpunished and unrebuked. The law pronounced death upon the adulterer, and the unnatural crime of Ammon made him doubly guilty. But David, self-condemned for his own sin, failed to bring the offender to justice. For two full years, Absalom, the natural protector of the sister so foully wronged, concealed his purpose of revenge, but only to strike more surely at the last. At the feast of the king's sons, the drunken, incestuous Ammon was slain by his brother's command. Twofold judgment had been meted out to David. The terrible message was carried to him: Absalom has slain all the king's sons, and there is not one of them left. Then the king arose and tore his garments and lay on the earth, and all his servants stood by with their clothes rent. The king's sons, returning in alarm to Jerusalem, revealed to their father the truth. Ammon alone had been slain, and they lifted up their voice and wept, and the king also and all his servants wept sore. But Absalom fled to Talmai, the king of Geshur, his mother's father. Like other sons of David, Ammon had been left to selfish indulgence. He had sought to gratify every thought of his heart, regardless of the requirements of God. Notwithstanding his great sin, God had borne long with him. For 2 years he had been granted opportunity for repentance, but he continued in sin with his guilt upon him. He was cut down by death to await the awful tribunal of the judgment. David had neglected the duty of punishing the crime of Ammon, and because of the unfaithfulness of the king and father, and the impenitence of the son, the Lord permitted events to take their natural course and did not restrain Absalom. When parents or rulers neglect the duty of punishing iniquity, God himself will take the case in hand. His restraining power will in a measure be removed from the agencies of evil, so that a train of circumstances will arise that will punish sin with sin. The evil results of David's unjust indulgence toward Ammon were not ended, for it was here that Absalom's alienation from his father began. After he fled to Geshur, David, feeling that the crime of his son demanded some punishment, refused him permission to return, and this had a tendency to increase rather than to lessen the inextricable evils in which the king had come to be involved. Absalom, energetic, ambitious, and unprincipled, shut out by his exile from participation in the affairs of the kingdom, soon gave himself up to dangerous scheming. At the close of 2 years, Joab determined to effect a reconciliation between the father and son, and with this object in view, he secured the services of a woman of Tekoa reputed for wisdom. Instructed by Joab, the woman represented herself to David as a widow whose two sons had been her only comfort and support. In a quarrel, one of these had slain the other, and now all the relatives of the family demanded that the survivor should be given up to the avenger of blood. "And so," said the mother, "they shall quench my coal which is left, and shall not leave to my husband neither name nor remainder upon the earth." The king's feelings were touched by this appeal, and he assured the woman of the royal protection for her son. After drawing from him repeated promises for the young man's safety, she entreated the king's forbearance, declaring that he had spoken as one at fault, in that he did not fetch home again his banished. "For," she said, "we must needs die, and are as water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Neither doth God respect any person, yet doth he devise means that his banished be not expelled from him." This tender and touching portrayal of the love of God toward the sinner, coming as it did from Joab, the rude soldier, is a striking evidence of the familiarity of the Israelites with the great truths of redemption. The king, feeling his own need of God's mercy, could not resist this appeal. To Joab the command was given, "Go therefore, bring the young man Absalom again." Absalom was permitted to return to Jerusalem, but not to appear at court or to meet his father. David had begun to see the evil effects of his indulgence toward his children, and tenderly as he loved this beautiful and gifted son, he felt it necessary as a lesson both to Absalom and to the people that abhorrence for such a crime should be manifested. Absalom lived 2 years in his own house, but banished from the court. His sister dwelt with him, and her presence kept alive the memory of the irreparable wrong she had suffered. In the popular estimation, the prince was a hero rather than an offender, and having this advantage, he set himself to gain the hearts of the people. His personal appearance was such as to win the admiration of all beholders. In all Israel, there was none to be so much praised as Absalom for his beauty. From the sole of his foot even to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. It was not wise for the king to leave a man of Absalom's character, ambitious, impulsive, and passionate, to brood for 2 years over supposed grievances. And David's action in permitting him to return to Jerusalem and yet refusing to admit him to his presence enlisted in his behalf the sympathies of the people. With the memory ever before him of his own transgression of the law of God, David seemed morally paralyzed. He was weak and irresolute when before his sin he had been courageous and decided. His influence with the people had been weakened, and all this favored the designs of his unnatural son. Through the influence of Joab, Absalom was again admitted to his father's presence, but though there was an outward reconciliation, he continued his ambitious scheming. He now assumed an almost royal state, having chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. And while the king was more and more inclined to desire retirement and solitude, Absalom sedulously courted the popular favor. The influence of David's listlessness and irresolution extended to his subordinates. Negligence and delay characterized the administration of justice. Absalom artfully turned every cause of dissatisfaction to his own advantage. Day by day, this man of noble mien might be seen at the gate of the city, where a crowd of suppliants waited to present their wrongs for redress. Absalom mingled with them and listened to their grievances, expressing sympathy with their sufferings and regret at the inefficiency of the government. Having thus listened to the story of a man of Israel, the prince would reply, "Thy matters are good and right, but there is no man deputed of the king to hear thee," adding, "Oh, that I were made judge in the land, that every man which hath any suit or cause might come unto me, and I would do him justice." And it was so that when any man came nigh to do him obeisance, he put forth his hands and took him and kissed him. Fomented by the artful insinuations of the prince, discontent with the government was fast spreading. The praise of Absalom was on the lips of all. He was generally regarded as heir to the kingdom. The people looked upon him with pride as worthy of this high station, and a desire was kindled that he might occupy the throne. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Yet the king, blinded by affection for his son, suspected nothing. The princely state which Absalom had assumed was regarded by David as intended to do honor to his court, as an expression of joy at the reconciliation. The minds of the people being prepared for what was to follow, Absalom secretly sent picked men throughout the tribes to concert measures for a revolt. And now the cloak of religious devotion was assumed to conceal his traitorous designs. A vow made long before while he was in exile must be paid in Hebron. Absalom said to the king, "I pray thee, let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed unto the Lord in Hebron. For thy servant vowed a vow while I abode in Geshur in Syria, saying, If the Lord shall bring me again indeed to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord." The fond father, comforted with this evidence of piety in his son, dismissed him with his blessing. The conspiracy was now fully matured. Absalom's crowning act of hypocrisy was designed not only to blind the king, but to establish the confidence of the people, and thus to lead them on to rebellion against the king whom God had chosen. Absalom set forth for Hebron, And there went with him 200 men out of Jerusalem that were called, and they went in their simplicity, and they knew not anything. These men went with Absalom, little thinking that their love for the son was leading them into rebellion against the father. Upon arriving at Hebron, Absalom immediately summoned Ahithophel, one of the chief counselors of David, a man in high repute for wisdom, whose opinion was thought to be as safe and wise as that of an oracle. Ahithophel joined the conspirators, and his support made the cause of Absalom appear certain of success, attracting to his standard many influential men from all parts of the land. As the trumpet of revolt was sounded, the prince's spies throughout the country spread the tidings that Absalom was king, and many of the people gathered to him. Meanwhile, the alarm was carried to Jerusalem to the king. David was suddenly aroused to see rebellion breaking out close beside his throne. His own son, the son whom he had loved and trusted, had been plotting to seize his crown and doubtless to take his life. In his great peril, David shook off the depression that had so long rested upon him, and with the spirit of his earlier years, he prepared to meet this terrible emergency. Absalom was mustering his forces at Hebron, only 20 miles away. The rebels would soon be at the gates of Jerusalem. From his palace, David looked out upon his capital, beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth, the city of the great king. He shuddered at the thought of exposing it to carnage and devastation. Should he call to his help the subject still loyal to his throne and make a stand to hold his capital? Should he permit Jerusalem to be deluged with blood? His decision was taken. The horrors of the war should not fall upon the chosen city. He would leave Jerusalem and then test the fidelity of his people, giving them an opportunity to rally to his support. In this great crisis, it was his duty to God and to his people to maintain the authority with which heaven had invested him. The issue of the conflict he would trust with God. In humility and sorrow, David passed out of the gate of Jerusalem, driven from his throne, from his palace, from the ark of God by the insurrection of his cherished son. The people followed in long, sad procession like a funeral train. David's bodyguard of Cherethites, Pelethites, and 600 Gittites from Gath, under the command of Ittai, accompanied the king. But David, with characteristic unselfishness, could not consent that these strangers who had sought his protection should be involved in his calamity. He expressed surprise that they should be ready to make this sacrifice for him. Then said the king to Ittai the Gittite, "Wherefore goest thou also with us? Return to thy place and abide with the king, for thou art a stranger and also an exile. Whereas thou camest but yesterday, should I this day make thee go up and down with us? Seeing I go whither I may, return thou and take back thy brethren. Mercy and truth be with thee." Ittai answered, "As the Lord liveth, and as my lord the king liveth, surely in what place my lord the king shall be, whether in death or life, even there also will thy servant be." These men had been converted from paganism to the worship of Jehovah, and nobly they now proved their fidelity to their God and their king. David, with grateful heart, accepted their devotion to his apparently sinking cause, and all passed over the brook Kedron on the way toward the wilderness. Again the procession halted. A company clad in holy vestments was approaching, and lo, Zadok also and all the Levites were with him, bearing the ark of the covenant of God. The followers of David looked upon this as a happy omen. The presence of that sacred symbol was to them a pledge of their deliverance and ultimate victory. It would inspire the people with courage to rally to the king. Its absence from Jerusalem would bring terror to the adherents of Absalom. At sight of the ark, joy and hope for a brief moment thrilled the heart of David, but soon other thoughts came to him. As the appointed ruler of God's heritage, he was under solemn responsibility. Not personal interests, but the glory of God and the good of his people were to be uppermost in the mind of Israel's king. God, who dwelt between the cherubim, had said of Jerusalem, "This is my rest." And without divine authority, neither priest nor king had a right to remove therefrom the symbol of his presence. and David knew that his heart and life must be in harmony with the divine precepts, else the ark would be the means of disaster rather than of success. His great sin was ever before him. He recognized in this conspiracy the just judgment of God. The sword that was not to depart from his house had been unsheathed. He knew not what the result of the struggle might be. It was not for him to remove from the capital of the nation the sacred statutes which embodied the will of their divine sovereign, which were the constitution of the realm and the foundation of its prosperity. He commanded Zadok, "Carry back the ark of God into the city. If I shall find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me again and show me both it and his habitation. But if he thus say, 'I have no delight in thee,' behold, here am I. Let him do to me as seemeth good unto him." David added, "Art not thou a seer, a man appointed of God to instruct the people? Return into the city in peace, and your two sons with you, Ahimeaz thy son, and Jonathan the son of Abiathar. See, I will tarry in the plain of the wilderness until there come word from you to certify me. In the city the priests might do him good service by learning the movements and purposes of the rebels and secretly communicating them to the king by their sons, Ahimeaz and Jonathan." As the priest turned back toward Jerusalem, a deeper shadow fell upon the departing throng, their king a fugitive, themselves outcast, forsaken even by the ark of God. The future was dark with terror and foreboding. And David went up by the ascent of Olivet and wept as he went up and had his head covered. And he went barefoot, and all the people that was with him covered every man his head. And they went up, weeping as they went up. One told David, saying, "Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom." Again David was forced to recognize in his calamities the result of his own sin. The defection of Ahithophel, the ablest and most wily of political leaders, was prompted by revenge for the family disgrace involved in the wrong to Bathsheba, who was his granddaughter. And David said, "O Lord, I pray thee, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness." Upon reaching the top of the mount, the king bowed in prayer, casting upon God the burden of his soul, and humbly supplicating divine mercy. His prayer seemed to be at once answered. Hushai the Archite, a wise and able counselor who had proved himself a faithful friend to David, now came to him with his robes rent and with earth upon his head to cast in his fortunes with the dethroned and fugitive king. David saw as by a divine enlightenment that this man, faithful and true-hearted, was the one needed to serve the interests of the king in the councils at the capital. At David's request, Hushai returned to Jerusalem to offer his services to Absalom and defeat the crafty counsel of Ahithophel. With this gleam of light in the darkness, the king and his followers pursued their way down the eastern slope of Olivet, through a rocky and desolate waste, through wild ravines, and along stony and precipitous paths toward the Jordan. And when King David came to Behurim, behold, thence came out a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. He came forth and cursed still as he came, and he cast stones at David and at all the servants of King David. And all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. And thus said Shimei when he cursed, come out, thou bloody man, and thou man of Belial. The Lord hath returned upon thee all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose stead thou hast reigned. And the Lord hath delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom thy son. And behold, thou art taken in thy mischief, because thou art a bloody man." In David's prosperity, Shimei had not shown by word or act that he was not a loyal subject. But in the affliction of the king, this Benjamite revealed his true character. He had honored David upon his throne, but he cursed him in his humiliation. Base and selfish, he looked upon others as of the same character as himself, and inspired by Satan, he wreaked his hatred upon him whom God had chastened. The spirit that leads man to triumph over or revile or distress one who is in affliction is the spirit of Satan. Shimei's accusations against David were utterly false, a baseless and malignant slander. David had not been guilty of wrong toward Saul or his house. When Saul was wholly in his power and he could have slain him, he merely cut the skirt of his robe, and he reproached himself for showing even this disrespect for the Lord's anointed. Of David's sacred regard for human life, striking evidence had been given even while he himself was hunted like a beast of prey. One day, while he was hidden in the cave of Adullam, his thoughts turning back to the untroubled freedom of his boyhood life, the fugitive exclaimed, "Oh, that one would give me drink of the water of the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate." Bethlehem was at that time in the hands of the Philistines, but three mighty men of David's band broke through the guard and brought of the water of Bethlehem to their master. David could not drink it. "Be it far from me," he cried. "Is not this the blood of the men that went in jeopardy for their lives?" And he reverently poured out the water as an offering to God. David had been a man of war. Much of his life had been spent amid scenes of violence. But of all who had passed through such an ordeal, few indeed had been so little affected by its hardening, demoralizing influence as was David. David's nephew, Abishai, one of the bravest of his captains, could not listen patiently to Shimei's insulting words. "Why," he exclaimed, "should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over, I pray thee, and take off his head." But the king forbade him. "Behold," he said, "my son seeketh my life. How much more now may this Benjamite do it? Let him alone, and let him curse, for the Lord hath bidden him. It may be that the Lord will look on mine affliction, and that the Lord will requite me good for his cursing this day." Conscience was uttering bitter and humiliating truths to David. While his faithful subjects wondered at his sudden reverse of fortune, it was no mystery to the king. He had often had forebodings of an hour like this. He had wondered that God had so long borne with his sins and had delayed the merited retribution. And now, in his hurried and sorrowful flight, his bare feet, his royal robes changed for sackcloth, the lamentations of his followers awakening the echoes of the hills, he thought of his loved capital, of the place which had been the scene of his sin, and as he remembered the goodness and long-suffering of God, he was not altogether without hope. He felt that the Lord would still deal with him in mercy. Many a wrongdoer has excused his own sin by pointing to David's fall, but how few there are who manifest David's penitence and humility. How few would bear reproof and retribution with the patience and fortitude that he manifested. He had confessed his sin, for years had sought to do his duty as a faithful servant of God. He had labored for the upbuilding of his kingdom, and under his rule it had attained a strength and prosperity never reached before. He had gathered rich stores of material for the building of the house of God, and now was all the labor of his life to be swept away? Must the results of years of consecrated toil, the work of genius and devotion and statesmanship, pass into the hands of his reckless and traitorous son, who regarded not the honor of God nor the prosperity of Israel? How natural it would have seemed for David to murmur against God in this great affliction. But he saw in his own sin the cause of his trouble. The words of the prophet Micah breathed the spirit that inspired David's heart. "When I sit in darkness, the Lord shall be a light unto me. I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned against him, until he plead my cause and execute judgment for me." And the Lord did not forsake David. This chapter in his experience, when under cruelest wrong and insult, he shows himself to be humble, unselfish, generous, and submissive, is one of the noblest in his whole experience. Never was the ruler of Israel more truly great in the sight of heaven than at this hour of his deepest outward humiliation. Had God permitted David to go on unrebuked in sin, and while transgressing the divine precepts to remain in peace and prosperity upon his throne, the skeptic and infidel might have had some excuse for citing the history of David as a reproach to the religion of the Bible. But in the experience through which he caused David to pass, the Lord shows that he cannot tolerate or excuse sin. And David's history enables us to see also the great ends which God has in view in His dealings with sin. It enables us to trace even through darkest judgments the working out of His purposes of mercy and beneficence. He caused David to pass under the rod, but He did not destroy him. The furnace is to purify, but not consume. The Lord says, "If they break my statutes and keep not my commandments, then will I visit their transgression with a rod and their iniquity with stripes. Nevertheless, my loving kindness will I not utterly take from him, nor suffer my faithfulness to fail." Soon after David left Jerusalem, Absalom and his army entered and without a struggle took possession of the stronghold of Israel. Hushai was among the first to greet the new crowned monarch, and the prince was surprised and gratified at the accession of his father's old friend and counselor. Absalom was confident of success. Thus far his schemes had prospered, and eager to strengthen his throne and secure the confidence of the nation, he welcomed Hushai to his court. Absalom was now surrounded by a large force, but it was composed mostly of men untrained for war. As yet they had not been brought into conflict. Ahithophel well knew that David's situation was far from hopeless. A large part of the nation were still true to him. He was surrounded by tried warriors who were faithful to their king, and his army was commanded by able and experienced generals. Ahithophel knew that after the first burst of enthusiasm in favor of the new king, a reaction would come. Should the rebellion fail, Absalom might be able to secure a reconciliation with his father. Then Ahithophel, as his chief counselor, would be held most guilty for the rebellion. Upon him the heaviest punishment would fall. To prevent Absalom from retracing his steps, Ahithophel counseled him to an act that in the eyes of the whole nation would make reconciliation impossible. With hellish cunning, this wily and unprincipled statesman urged Absalom to add the crime of incest to that of rebellion. In the sight of all Israel, he was to take to himself his father's concubines according to the custom of Oriental nations, thus declaring that he succeeded to his father's throne. And Absalom carried out the vile suggestion. Thus was fulfilled the word of God to David by the prophet, "Behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house, and I will take thy wives before thine eyes and give them unto thy neighbor. For thou didst it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun." Not that God prompted these acts of wickedness, but because of David's sin, he did not exercise his power to prevent them. Ahithophel had been held in high esteem for his wisdom, but he was destitute of the enlightenment which comes from God. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and this Ahithophel did not possess, or he could hardly have based the success of treason upon the crime of incest. Men of corrupt hearts plot wickedness as if there were no overruling providence to cross their designs. But he that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh, the Lord shall have them in derision. The Lord declares, "They would none of my counsel, they despised all my reproof. Therefore shall they eat of the fruit of their own way and be filled with their own devices. For the turning away of the simple shall slay them, and the prosperity of fools shall destroy them." Having succeeded in the plot for securing his own safety, Ahithophel urged upon Absalom the necessity of immediate action against David. "Let me now choose out 12,000 men," he said, "and I will arise and pursue after David this night, and I will come upon him while he is weary and weak-handed, and will make him afraid. And all the people that are with him shall flee, and I will smite the king only, and I will bring back all the people unto thee." This plan was approved by the king's counselors. Had it been followed, David would surely have been slain unless the Lord had directly interposed to save him. But a wisdom higher than that of the renowned Ahithophel was directing events. The Lord had appointed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring evil upon Absalom. Hushai had not been called to the council, and he would not intrude himself unasked, lest suspicion should be drawn upon him as a spy. But after the assembly had dispersed, Absalom, who had a high regard for the judgment of his father's counselor, submitted to him the plan of Ahithophel. Hushai saw that if the proposed plan were followed, David would be lost. And he said that the counsel that Ahithophel hath given is not good at this time. For, said Hushai, thou knowest thy father and his men, that they be mighty men, and they be chafed in their minds as a bear robbed of her whelps in the field. And thy father is a man of war, and will not lodge with the people. Behold, he is hid now in some pit or in some other place. He argued that if Absalom's forces should pursue David, they would not capture the king, and should they suffer a reverse, it would tend to dishearten them and work great harm to Absalom's cause. For he said, all Israel knoweth that thy father is a mighty man, and they which be with him are valiant men. And he suggested a plan attractive to a vain and selfish nature, fond of the show of power. I counsel that all Israel be generally gathered together unto thee, from Dan even to Beersheba, as the sand that is by the sea for multitude, and that thou go to battle in thine own person. So shall we come upon him in some place where he shall be found, and we will light upon him as the dew falleth on the ground, and of him and of all the men that are with him there shall not be left so much as one. Moreover, if he be gotten into a city, then shall all Israel bring ropes to that city, and we will draw it into the river until there be not one small stone found there. And Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. But there was one who was not deceived, one who clearly foresaw the result of this fatal mistake of Absalom's. Ahithophel knew that the cause of the rebels was lost, and he knew that whatever might be the fate of the prince, there was no hope for the counselor who had instigated his greatest crimes. Ahithophel had encouraged Absalom in rebellion. He had counseled him to the most abominable wickedness, to the dishonor of his father. He advised the slaying of David and had planned its accomplishment. He had cut off the last possibility of his own reconciliation with the king, and now another was preferred before him, even by Absalom. Jealous, angry, and desperate, Ahithophel got him home to his house, to his city, and put his household in order and hanged himself and died. Such was the result of the wisdom of one who, with all his high endowments, did not make God his counselor. Satan allures men with flattering promises, but in the end it will be found by every soul that the wages of sin is death. Hushai, not certain that his counsel would be followed by the fickle king, lost no time in warning David to escape beyond Jordan without delay. To the priests who were to forward it by their sons, Hushai sent the message, thus and thus did Ahithophel counsel Absalom and the elders of Israel, and thus have I counseled. Now therefore lodge not this night in the plains of the wilderness, but speedily pass over, lest the king be swallowed up and all the people that are with him. The young men were suspected and pursued, yet they succeeded in performing their perilous mission. David, spent with toil and grief after that first day of flight, received the message that he must cross the Jordan that night, for his son was seeking his life. What were the feelings of the father and king so cruelly wronged in this terrible peril? A mighty valiant man, a man of war, a king whose word was law, betrayed by his son, whom he had loved and indulged and unwisely trusted, wronged and deserted by subjects bound to him by the strongest ties of honor and fealty. In what words did David pour out the feelings of his soul? In the hour of his darkest trial, David's heart was stayed upon God, and he sang, Lord, how are they increased that trouble me? Many are they that rise up against me. Many there be which say of my soul, there is no help for him in God. But thou, O Lord, art a shield for me, my glory and the lifter up of mine head. I cried unto the Lord with my voice, and he heard me out of his holy hill. I laid me down and slept. I awaked, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people that have set themselves against me round about. Salvation belongeth unto the Lord. Thy blessing is upon thy people. Psalm 3:1-8. David and all his company, warriors and statesmen, old men and youth, the women and the little children in the darkness of night, crossed the deep and swift-flowing river. by the morning light. There lacked not one of them that was not gone over Jordan. David and his forces fell back to Maanaim, which had been the royal seat of Ishbosheth. This was a strongly fortified city surrounded by a mountainous district favorable for retreat in case of war. The country was well provisioned and the people were friendly to the cause of David. Here many adherents joined him, while wealthy tribesmen brought abundant gifts of provision and other needed supplies. Hushai's counsel had achieved its object, gaining for David opportunity for escape. But the rash and impetuous prince could not be long restrained, and he soon set out in pursuit of his father. And Absalom passed over Jordan, he and all the men of Israel with him. Absalom made Amasa, the son of David's sister Abigail, commander-in-chief of his forces. His army was large, but it was undisciplined and poorly prepared to cope with the tried soldiers of his father. David divided his forces into three battalions under the command of Joab, Abishai, and Ittai the Gittite. It had been his purpose himself to lead his army in the field, but against this the officers of the army, the counselors, and the people vehemently protested. "Thou shalt not go forth," they said, "for if we flee away, they will not care for us. Neither if half of us die will they care for us. But thou art worth 10,000 of us. Therefore now it is better that thou be ready to succor us out of the city." And the king said unto them, "What seemeth to you best I will do." From the walls of the city the long lines of the rebel army were in full view. The usurper was accompanied by a vast host, in comparison with which David's force seemed but a handful. But as the king looked upon the opposing forces, the thought uppermost in his mind was not of the crown and the kingdom, nor of his own life that depended upon the wage of battle. The father's heart was filled with love and pity for his rebellious son. As the army filed out from the city gates, David encouraged his faithful soldiers, bidding them go forth, trusting that the God of Israel would give them the victory. But even here he could not repress his love for Absalom. As Joab, leading the first column, passed his king, the conqueror of 100 battlefields stooped his proud head to hear the monarch's last message, as with trembling voice he said, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom." And Abishai and Ittai received the same charge, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom." But the king's solicitude, seeming to declare that Absalom was dearer to him than his kingdom, dearer even than the subjects faithful to his throne, only increased the indignation of the soldiers against the unnatural son. The place of battle was a wood near the Jordan, in which the great numbers of Absalom's army were only a disadvantage to him. Among the thickets and marshes of the forest, these undisciplined troops became confused and unmanageable, and the people of Israel were slain before the servants of David, and there was there a great slaughter that day of 20,000 men. Absalom, seeing that the day was lost, had turned to flee when his head was caught between the branches of a wide-spreading tree, and his mule going out from under him, he was left helplessly suspended, a prey to his enemies. In this condition he was found by a soldier who, for fear of displeasing the king, spared Absalom, but reported to Joab what he had seen. Joab was restrained by no scruples. He had befriended Absalom, having twice secured his reconciliation with David, and the trust had been shamelessly betrayed. But for the advantages gained by Absalom through Joab's intercession, this rebellion, with all its horrors, could never have occurred. Now was in Joab's power at one blow to destroy the instigator of all this evil. And he took three darts in his hand and thrust them through the heart of Absalom. And they took Absalom and cast him into a great pit in the wood and laid a very great heap of stones upon him. Thus perished the instigator of rebellion in Israel. Ahithophel had died by his own hand. The princely Absalom, whose glorious beauty had been the pride of Israel, had been cut down in the vigor of his youth, his dead body thrust into a pit and covered with a heap of stones in token of everlasting reproach. During his lifetime, Absalom had reared for himself a costly monument in the king's dale,
but the only memorial which marked his grave was that heap of stones in the wilderness. The leader of the rebellion being slain, Joab, by the sounding of the trumpet, recalled his army from the pursuit of the fleeing host, and messengers were at once dispatched to bear the tidings to the king. The watchman upon the city wall, looking out toward the battlefield, discovered a man running alone. Soon a second came in sight. As the first drew nearer, the watchman said to the king, who was waiting beside the gate, "Methinketh the running of the foremost is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok." And the king said, "He is a good man, and cometh with good tidings." And Ahimaaz called and said unto the king, "All is well." And he fell down to the earth upon his face before the king, and said, "Blessed be the Lord thy God, which hath delivered up the men that lifted up their hand against my lord the king." To the king's eager inquiry, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" Ahimaaz returned an evasive answer. The second messenger came crying, "Tidings, my lord the king, for the Lord hath avenged thee this day of all them that rose up against thee." Again from the father's lips came the absorbing question, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" Unable to conceal the heavy tidings, the herald answered, "The enemies of my lord the king and all that rise up against thee to do thee hurt, be as that young man is." It is enough. David questioned no further, but with bowed head he went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went thus, he said, "O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son, my son." The victorious army, returning from the field, approached the city, their shouts of triumph awakening the echoes of the hills. But as they entered the city gate, the shout died away, their banners drooped in their hands, and with downcast gaze they advanced more like those who had suffered defeat than like conquerors. For the king was not waiting to bid them welcome, but from the chamber above the gate his wailing cry was heard, "O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son." The victory that day was turned into mourning unto all the people, for the people heard say that day how the king was grieved for his son. And the people got them by stealth that day into the city, as people being ashamed steal away when they flee in battle. Joab was filled with indignation. God had given them reason for triumph and gladness. The greatest rebellion that had ever been known in Israel had been crushed, and yet this great victory was turned to mourning for him whose crime had cost the blood of thousands of brave men. The rude, blunt captain pushed his way into the presence of the king and boldly said, "Thou hast shamed this day the faces of all thy servants, which this day have saved thy life and the lives of thy sons and of thy daughters, in that thou lovest thine enemies and hatest thy friends. For thou hast declared this day that thou regardest neither princes nor servants. For this day I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all we had died this day, then it had pleased thee well. Now therefore arise, go forth, and speak comfortably unto thy servants. For I swear by the Lord, if thou go not forth, there shall not tarry one with thee this night, and that will be worse unto thee than all the evil that befell thee from thy youth until now." Harsh and even cruel as was the reproof to the heart-stricken king, David did not resent it. Seeing that his general was right, he went down to the gate and with words of courage and commendation greeted his brave soldiers as they marched past him.